everyone, and welcome to another episode of United Voices, the podcast where we highlight people, partners, and programs shaping a stronger and more inclusive Waterloo region. My name is Kyla Musgrave, and I'm part of the team behind United Voices Waterloo Region. In today's conversation, my colleague Ajin speaks with Cameron Dearlove, the Executive Director of Porchlight, an organization at the heart of community mental health and housing support in Cambridge, North Dumfries, and beyond. With so much to cover, today's episode is a special, almost double-length show. Cameron brings both vision and lived experience to this important conversation, highlighting the connection between mental health struggles and many other areas of challenge in our region. Passing the mic to Ajin and Cameron.
Hi, everyone. Joining us is Cameron Dearlove, the Executive Director of Porchlight Counseling Addiction Services. Hi, Cameron. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Ajin. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
Of course, and thank you for letting me speak to you. I just wanted to ask if you can give us a brief snapshot of Porchlight and the work your team is doing in the community right now.
Yeah, I mean, I can, you know, I don't know if it's brief in that we're doing a lot of great things. So a little bit about Porchlight. A lot of people think that we're a new organization, but we've actually been serving Cambridge for 85 years. This is our 85th anniversary. And we previously were called Family Counseling Center of Cambridge and North Dumfries, and we renamed just a few years ago. But one of the reasons that we renamed is that, of course, we're a counseling agency for many decades, and we still are, but our work has expanded. And so we needed a name that kind of encompassed all that we were doing. So, of course, counseling, core to what we do. We're a member agency of the Counseling Collaborative of Waterloo Region. Our focus is on making sure that people have access to counseling and mental health supports that they need. And that access means, you know, affordability. The vast majority of the counseling that we do is free. It's funded by various funders. So as an example, we do violence against women counseling that's funded through provincial government. We do counseling for people who are in Ontario Works and Ontario Disability Support Program that's funded through the Region of Waterloo. We provide counseling that's funded through OHIP with a doctor's referral. And so there are a whole bunch of different pathways that people can take to get services at Porchlight when it comes to counseling. But we're also, over the last couple of years, been working on getting our counseling work out into the community as well, into different spaces. So as an example, for the last few years, we've been sending a counselor to MAX, which is the multi-agency community space. It's a homeless drop-in program run by Thrive HIV. So we send a counselor for that. We've had a counselor involved in the SHI program, which provides counseling for supportive housing buildings. We now have a counselor, both a counselor and an addictions counselor, embedded in the YWCA Cambridge's new women's emergency shelter, and a number of other ways that we get our counseling out into the community. So it's not just about, you know, who's coming in our doors, but also how we're out there meeting the community where they're at as well. So, you know, that's our counseling supports that we provide. And that's, you know, the traditional support that we have. About 9 years ago or so, there was an addictions program that was running through the Cambridge Shelter, and they didn't have funding for the program and needed to close it. And so our agency stepped in and took that on and became then, you know, an addictions support provider as well. So the core to our work is we provide case management referral support, particularly for people who are facing a lot of complexity. So usually people who are experiencing homelessness or precariously housed, you know, we take a really hands-on approach in helping people to get into withdrawal management or treatment or recovery living. And then when it comes to recovery living, we actually run two houses with a total of 19 beds for people who are living in recovery and don't have, you know, a safe place to live. So, you know, historically, if somebody was, say, for example, in shelter and they wanted to get into a treatment program, they might go off to the treatment program for a couple of months and then come back. But their housing situation hasn't changed and they end up back in shelter and in the same environment that they were facing their addiction. And so that's why our recovery homes are so important. People can live there for, you know, typically 9 or 10 months, but some people for several years while they're rebuilding their life in the community. So that's our addictions work. And over the last couple of years, we've started to do a lot more in the way of housing and homelessness. So, you know, of course, our recovery homes, we have 19 beds, but we've also started doing some other programs as well. So, for example, we run a program supporting homeless veterans, which is supported with the Region of Waterloo. And as well, this past winter, we ran an overnight warming center where we provided shelter for 30 to 40 people a night. And our hope for the future is that we start to actually build housing as well.
Amazing. And Porchlight does a lot, and you mentioned both housing and mental health, and those are very deeply entwined. So I just wanted to ask how Porchlight supports people along that complex journey from crisis to stability. And would you also be able to speak about the big gaps in the system that makes this journey kind of hard for those individuals?
Yeah, so great question. And of course, housing and homelessness are so intertwined. You know, we oftentimes think of, you know, well, we're a mental health agency. You know, what could be more core to someone's mental health than their housing? You know, the place they find safety and shelter, right? And so that's also, you know, as Porchlight's been kind of stepping into the housing space, it just makes sense with what we're doing, because sometimes, you know, we're seeing new programs where we're having counselors who are going into housing buildings, supportive housing buildings, the shelters. You know, we play a role in supporting the mental health kind of across that continuum of housing, and something that, you know, I hope that we continue to grow on, because as you said, you use the word crisis. Like we're in a crisis when it comes to mental health, addictions, and obviously housing. And so Porchlight, we had lots of discussions at the board table. You know, are we a housing agency? And I would say, you know, we do house 19 people in our recovery housing, but also it's, you know, what lens do we bring to this? So it's, we're not looking to be just a general housing agency. We're interested in supporting people in their housing, finding housing that's safe, but also with a lens of mental health and addictions. Where do I see the biggest gaps? So that is a really good question. And I'll just kind of back up and say, you know, here's kind of the way that I see the way that we build systems when it comes to kind of social services, social supports. Oftentimes we build them around the capacity, and the convenience of the service providers rather than necessarily the clients. You know, most of us do 9 to 5s or something like that, and don't leave a lot of spaces and other times for people who are working or working shift work. So we think a lot about our own, you know, kind of organizational structures. Doesn't always meet the needs of everybody. And I think for most people, the systems that we set up do work. But there are a lot of folks, especially those who are facing a lot of complexity, where the systems, the pathways that we've created often don't work as well or present barriers, or people just get lost in them or can't even find them to begin with. And oftentimes in my work, that's the group that I'm really focused on, that 10% of people who struggle with traditional systems. I give the example of our, you know, addictions support, where focus is on people who are experiencing lots of complexity and like I said, usually experiencing homelessness. You know, a typical system where you get appointments to that you need to keep and phone calls that you need to make. Somebody who's experiencing homelessness who may not have a phone, they don't know where they're going to be the next day, let alone the next week. That's not going to work as well for them. And so, you know, that's where we take a really hands-on approach. And I think that that's an important consideration for any systems that we're designing, that we should understand that we're not going to get everybody, right? And no matter how big we create that funnel, there are people that it's not going to work for. And so we need to also make sure that we have pathways and supports to get everybody the supports that they need. More specifically, I think biggest gaps I see are in Cambridge. And so this is something that I speak a lot about in my work. Sometimes I feel like, yeah, a big part of my job is going to meetings and saying, you know, hey, you know, have you thought about Cambridge? Or, you know, maybe we haven't considered the needs of Cambridge here. You know, we typically have a regional system for supports. We all fall within the Waterloo region, and we need to have a really integrated system and collaborative system. We also need to think about geographic equity and access. And so when access points are, you know, say always in Kitchener, then it reduces access for people in Cambridge and the townships. This is something that I think a conversation that we're hearing more and more about, you know, the need for services in Cambridge. You know, I can see that getting embedded in a lot of good work. The YWCA Cambridge really stepped up over the last couple of years in developing a women's shelter in Cambridge. That's been a gap for years, and so amazing to finally have an agency who can step forward and provide that service in Cambridge. But then we have to look at the whole continuum and say, okay, so we filled, you know, that shelter gap. But what about the supportive housing gap? What about the affordable housing gap? You know, do the women coming into the YWCA shelter, do they have supportive housing unit to go to in Cambridge? And the answer is no, we don't have any dedicated women supportive housing in Cambridge. So if that was a need, then they would need to move into another community. And I think, you know, we can do better than that.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Cameron. You mentioned a lot about gaps, and it is very hard to kind of please everyone. And I know in the nonprofit sector, it is a necessity even to wear multiple hats. And so I commend you and Porchlight for the resilience that you have. And I did want to just touch about some of the more initiatives that you and Porchlight have, such as the warming center that you discussed before. So I wanted to ask, could you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, you know, I mean, we've had, you know, conversations at from a strategic level about how involved we get into housing, that sort of thing. The warming center came up just the beginning of January. The region was looking for providers to open overnight warming centers in Kitchener and in Cambridge. They had a provider step forward in Kitchener. They had a provider that stepped forward in Cambridge, but they were not able to follow through. And so the region put out kind of a call to anybody. Is there anybody that can help here? And pass that on to our board of directors. You know, I sort of figured that they would say, you know, boy, that's complex work and we're not used to doing that. Timeline, we've got a lot going on already. And I was really proud of their response, which was, well, that's not work that we've traditionally done, but somebody has to do it. And in this case, it sounds like it's us. And I thought that was just really amazing. Oftentimes boards get really worried about, you know, risk management and things like that. And their concern was for the community. I was really proud of the board for having that perspective. And we're also really fortunate that we have a great partnership with the Wesley United Church town. We actually have our addictions office in Wesley United Church, and we also bake there on Wednesdays. We have a social enterprise with our recovery homes, and so we bake there and sell tarts and jams and things like that. Right? So we have a long history with Wesley, and they immediately stepped up and said, yes, we can host this here. Really amazing once we got into the church and just saw how much activity there was. It's really a community hub. There's so many different programs that are happening. So what we did was on February 1st, we opened up an overnight warming center. So 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. There would be food, sleeping mats, blankets, very basic supports, but really, really low barrier. So when people are coming in, we're kind of asking their name, their age, and then we welcome them in. And so we provided that for 3 months. So every night for 3 months, and it closed at the end of April. By the end of the warming center, we were seeing upwards of 40 men a night, which, you know, really paints a picture of, you know, how many people are out there, especially living unsheltered. You know, the recent PIC count, which is the point in time count, where based on one day, we try to count and engage with as many people who are experiencing homelessness to get a picture of how many people are truly out there. And the number that they came up with is over 2,400 people that they engaged in one day who were experiencing homelessness in Waterloo Region. And so we know that that's probably an undercount as well. And so there are a lot of folks that are out there that we, you know, maybe don't even know about. And by opening this kind of space, then people at least had access to, you know, some basic supports and resources. You know, something that I don't think needs to be tied to warming or cooling. People still wanted shelter on May 1st. Right. Even though we closed and said, hey, you know, the weather's getting better. And, you know, it would be really nice if we could provide that kind of low barrier shelter option year round. I think it's really important. So it's something that we're going to look to restart that again this year and hopefully run it for, you know, much longer period of time and maybe improve the support as we can. It's a really wonderful experience, really difficult experience because you also, you know, you see the depth of need that people have. One of the surprises, and maybe it wasn't a surprise, but you know, we took very basic information when people came in. So as I said, you know, kind of 40 people on average night. The average age that we saw at our warming center was 48, which I think is higher than a lot of people would expect, but also goes to show just, you know, the range of ages that people are where people are experiencing homelessness, seeing a lot more older adults who are winding up needing homelessness support. So, you know, I think the face of homelessness is continuing to change and develop and again, so our supports need to change and develop to meet all those needs.
Wow, that is amazing. And I completely understand that reluctance, or more so that fear of just you're crossing your fingers and hoping that the board says yes to this initiative. And I'm glad to see how far that it went. And I completely agree with you where it's kind of needed all year round, not just here and there. And I'm sure for those 40 or more, 40 is a lot, by the way. I don't know if the listeners know this, but imagine 40 people in your room right now. That's a lot of people. So servicing them, and I can just imagine just the community that was created over there. So I completely understand that those individuals would want something more long term. So I think that is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I just want to praise you a little bit. You've worked in policy and advocacy and also as a frontline leadership. So your resume must be stacked. But I just wanted to ask, what do you wish more people understood about the housing and mental health crisis from your systems perspective?
Well, thanks for that. So, you know, what do I want people to know? Sometimes I fear I come off a little pessimistic sometimes, but I'd like to call it realistic. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that I want to say is that I don't really feel that there is anything in place right now to solve and mitigate the crises that we're facing. So when it comes to housing, mental health, addictions, food security, cost of living, There's nothing coming down the pipe that's going to fix it. There are funds that are coming to build more housing. This is really good, right? So what I say, there's nothing in place. There's nothing that's going to solve the problem. This will solve the problem for some individuals. This is going to be great, but we need to build a lot more than we have planned if we're going to get out of, this housing crisis. There are targeted grants for mental health. So, for example, the federal government came out with a youth mental health fund, which was a national fund that you could apply for. So that's nice, but it doesn't replace ongoing year after year funding from, government funding for counseling. And one of the things that we're seeing even from funders is that they're more reluctant to fund counseling. We had a lot of support during the pandemic because people recognized, of course, we need counseling supports. The need has not dropped. It's only grown. But after the pandemic, we've sort of forgotten about counseling. And what we're hearing even funders is that, well, that should be government funded. So, that's not grant for. And again, that's, yes, it is government funded. Is it sufficiently funded? No, we're struggling quite a bit. I think that, for people in the community sitting back I think my message there is just that if you're feeling confident that like, oh, our politicians, our government, our bureaucracy, they have this under control. I don't think it is. And I feel pessimistic for saying that, but I think in many cases, such as addictions and substance use, we're going backwards and actually making the supports worse. Talking about taking away CTS, harm reduction, looking at forced treatment and things like that. Like we're going down a very concerning road, especially when we're going to invest in some of these other things, when there's a whole list of people that need the support right now and we don't have the resources for. So yeah, I think in a lot of ways we're ignoring the problems and just kind of hoping that they go away or that in a few years they'll settle in some way. And I think it's such a shame because sometimes we're reluctant to do big things or to make bold plans, And credit to the Region of Waterloo who created the plan to end chronic homelessness. And it's named the plan to end chronic homelessness, right? So we've got a goal that's in the name of the plan. Will council be there to support the plan through? Will the provincial and federal governments step up with the funding needed to really implement the plan? That's the question that we have. And that's where I say at all levels of government, we're not really meeting the need, or we provide kind of band-aid level of funding and expect that those band-aids are going to be sufficient. And of course they're not, especially when we see more people in need. Yeah, I just hope that we can try to think a little bit bigger, be bolder, set some really bold goals, and try to back it up with the resources and supports that we need. And I'll give an example. I think it was the city of Kitchener, right? There was a goal that they had towards zero traffic fatalities, which awesome, right? I mean, that would be great if you have, a city the size of Kitchener or whether it's Waterloo Region, and our goal is zero traffic fatalities, then that means that when there is one, we're gonna try and find ways to make that intersection safer. How could we prevent that kind of thing in the future? That's big thinking, right? At the same time, we lose far more people to drug overdose deaths than we do to traffic fatalities. But we're not boldly saying we're going to have zero overdose deaths. That's our goal, right? Why not? Can't we? Can we do that? Obviously, it's going to take a lot of, different approaches, resources. Maybe we don't get there, but we should try. And instead, we just see year after year the number of drug poisoning fatalities, it's just astronomical. When you look from 2016 to today, more people have died from opioids than died during the Second World War. It's just such a staggering number. Find another way that, we would lose 44,000 people and that we're not really taking bold steps to address it. So I think that's, I don't know, I guess we can do these big things, right? We can make progress and, get to zero chronic homelessness. I think these things are possible, but we need bold goals. We need a whole lot of collaboration, but we also need, I think, pressure on our governments that we're serious. As Canadians, we expect better. So yeah, that's my hope is that, I don't know, somewhere along the way we get a little bit more serious about some of these issues.
I completely agree, and that was beautifully well said, Cameron. Thank you for that. I want to label you as a pessimist. I would say you're a realist. I would say you call things as they are, and some things take priority. And I completely agree with you with everything that you just said. And you did touch on some community partnerships, such as the Women's Shelter and the Region of Waterloo. But I just wanted to ask about United Way and what does that partnership mean to you and the people you serve?
Yeah, so the United Way, I've somehow been in this sector for 16 years now. It's kind of flown by, but United Way has been a consistent along that journey. First job was at the Working Center, United Way funded agency. I was the first executive director of Bridges to Belonging. And the day that we got United Way funding, that was the day we arrived. You know, it was very much a startup, you know, kind of agency. And once we were a United Way member agency, man, that was a big deal for us. That was our legitimacy, right? United Way says that we're worthy of funding. I was at the Cambridge Food Bank again, you know, a United Way partner agency. Porchlight, we're supported by the United Way as well. So it's always been part of my journey. I was at the United Way partner meeting last week. One comment that I made is that this is the most important funder in the community. Obviously, taking out, you know, government funders, but for private foundation funders, I believe that United Way is the most important as far as what it provides to agencies. So that's not to say that the work of all these other funders is not important. It absolutely is. And we rely on multiple funders for our work. But the role that the United Way plays in A, providing advocacy and exposure for agencies, but it's the consistent year after year funding and year after year funding where we don't have to perform. And by perform, I mean, we don't have to create a new pilot project just to get funding. We can come back. We can do the same things year after year because they're proven and they work. And the United Way would be there to fund us continuously. You know, I don't have to try to make counseling sound new and different. The United Way just knows that this is an important support for our community. So yeah, for me, the United Way has been, you know, that consistent funder in the community and provides, you know, a lot of real unifying force. With that said, you know, we certainly see, and this is across the province, we hear this from our partner agencies and all other communities, is the challenge of declining United Way funding as donors change, as fewer people give. So that's a real problem for us because, like I said, this is the funder that's been the most consistent for a lot of agencies for a long time. And so, you know, it's really important that our United Way is strong, that it is raising the funds that are needed for the community. And so that would be my message is, you know, we've got to make sure that those donations are coming in because of that really important role that United Way plays.
I completely agree with you. And thank you so much for that. I feel that we do have a common enemy in terms of just low funding that has been occurring overall. And we do want to keep up the consistency and just funding for the community in general. But yeah, we just need a little more from the community as well, or donations and stuff like that. So we are trying our best and we want to make sure that organizations like Porchlight receive the funding and do what amazing things that you have been doing. So as we near the end, I just wanted to ask, what's something that gives you hope right now? Maybe a moment, a story, a shift you've seen that reminds you that, you know, maybe this is worth it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And yeah, sometimes people will ask me that, you know, because I'll be honest about the way that I, you know, see the state of things. And, you know, and I can give examples of that. Like last year, we saw more than 1,100 more unique individuals than we saw the previous year. So we supported 1,100 more people, which is 38% increase in the number of people that we served year over year, which is remarkable that we were able to do that, but our wait list grew. Mm-hmm. How does that happen? Right? I mean, you look at that and you go, okay, so we've grown, we've tried our best to meet the need, but it turns out that there's more out there. And so it can be really, you know, really frustrating and difficult. And, you know, closing the warming center was really difficult because we knew that these guys are not moving into housing tomorrow. They're moving into tents. And so it doesn't feel very good closing this space for them. So a lot of times there are things that be really easy to get down on things. For me, what gives me kind of hope and builds my resilience, I think, is just focusing on some of the people that work in this sector. They're the best. You know, yes, okay, pessimistic, realistic about, you know, supports and about the future, but none of that has anything to do with the frontline staff that are doing the work day in, day out. You know, I'm complaining about resourcing for them, right? It's so that they're better able to do their jobs. I've been involved in the sector for some time. I've been involved in creating a number of strategic plans or part of, you know, the strategic planning process for organizations I've been involved in. And whenever we have the exercise where we're listing off, you know, what are our values, a number of times I've suggested love. And usually people go, yeah, I get where you're going with that, but it sounds weird. So we take it out. And I go, yeah, fair enough. That's okay. But, you know, in English, we just have one word for love. And, you know, the ancient Greeks had multiple words for love and different kinds of love. So one was agape, which is kind of like a brotherly love, a community love. And that's what I'm talking about, right? You know, if you want to see love in action, go find some frontline workers, go find some outreach workers who are, you know, trudging through the forest to find some folks and to get make sure that they have water and what they need. Yeah, the people who are welcoming someone into a shelter, the counselors who are greeting a kid each day for their counseling session. Yeah, this idea of like love of community, right? This is what we see in action. And I think it's a beautiful thing. If anyone wants to be inspired, just look at the people who are doing the frontline work in this sector. They are some of the best people you're going to meet. They usually do not get the pay that they deserve. They don't get the recognition that they deserve. And oftentimes, you know, they don't have the resources and the supports that they need to really do their job well. But they still do it every day because they're there for the people, right? They're there for the community. And so, yeah, they're the best of us. That's one thing that gives me hope is I can kind of look at the work that, you know, our frontline staff are doing and see the kind of passion and the love that they bring into their work. Yeah, for me, that gives me hope.
That was beautiful. I will be adding agape to my vocabulary personally. But yeah, and oftentimes those frontline workers are always the ones with the biggest smiles on their faces. And yet, as you say, they have a lack of recognition, a lack of pay, and they wake up every day and they're very motivated to do what they are doing. So yeah, very beautiful points. Our time is coming to an end on this podcast. But before we wrap up, I wanted to ask if you had any final thoughts to share with our community or our listeners.
Yeah, I think just the message there is that we face major challenges, a number of crises, and I think that the solutions to solve those exist already. They exist in the community with those frontline workers. They exist with the people in the community who need supports. It's an amazing thing that if you talk to people about what they need, they often have a pretty good idea of it. And if we can just implement a little bit more of that, then maybe we can make some good progress. We've got, you know, really strong organizations. We've got people who really, really care and have answers. And, you know, we just need to listen to the community and then make sure that the community and those people who are doing the work are resourced to be able to really make an impact. And from there, I think that collaboratively, collectively, we can make a real difference.
Nice. Thank you so much, Cameron, for speaking with me and for your time today. I hope you had a wonderful conversation with me.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for doing this and for inviting me on. This is my first ever podcast, so this was exciting.
Thank you so much, Cameron.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cameron, for sharing your insight and your passion and helping to make our region a better place for everyone. And for those of you listening, remember that real change is local, and every small act of compassion helps to build a stronger and more connected Waterloo region. Follow United Voices for more stories like this, and join us in creating a community where everyone can thrive. If you want to learn more about Porchlight or support their work, you can visit fcccnd.com. Until next time, stay kind and stay united.